signal generator written down as an equation, and I take 1 over that, I call that Z, the impedance of that signal generator. I take 1 over Z that Mel just told you is called admittance. It's usually represented by the letter Y. 1 over Z, they call it Y, one letter away in the alphabet. It is a 50-ohm generator in series, which is 1 over 50, which is something like 20 millimoes. If I take 1 over 50 and do the division, I get a number of 0.02. That's 0.02 mo. Mo is ohm backwards. So it tells you you're dividing, you're using the shunting phenomenon.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, you're using the shunting phenomenon, so people will call it mo instead of ohm. It's just ohm spelled backwards. And 1 over 50 is 0.02. So it's 0.02 mo, which happens to equal 20 millimoes. So 20 millimoes of resistance and 50 ohms of resistance is the exact same component. It's an Allen Bradley resistor with a color code for 50, which I guess is a green, brown, black, I think it is, yes. In either case, it is an Allen Bradley 50-ohm resistor. If I use it in series, I call it a 50-ohm series impedance. If I use it in shunt, I call it a 20 millimo conductance. It's the exact same thing, just a matter of how I'm using it and how I arrange the mathematics. So conductance and resistance have a strong relationship to each other, 1 over. And by the way, you're about to see that the exact same thing happens with reactants. I won't go there. So now you know the relationship between Sevenen and Norton. As a black box from the outside world, you can't tell the difference, even though the schematic diagram inside is slightly different. When you're building a shunt stub tuning device on your antenna, you're really doing something that's Norton-like. You're putting impedances and reactances in shunt. That's a Norton, and that's why you use admittance and conductance, the 1 over formulas. I'll admit the first time you hear this jazz, you'll say to yourself, gee, why did they make it so darn complicated? Can't we make this easier? Can't we keep it a 50-ohm resistor and just tell somebody that it's 50 ohms across instead of 50 ohms in series? Yeah, they could have done it that way. But they call it mohs instead of ohms when they're using it in shunt. You'll get used to it. You're now learning the vocabulary that these guys use when they're doing this jazz and they're writing the articles. It'll eventually make a little more sense. You'll have to hear it a couple of times before it sinks in. That's normal. And if you're frustrated, you'll learn it. K2KEY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, the TechNet, K2KEY, that's why I was trying to keep this simple, because I see, I was trying to stay away as much from it as possible right now, Dick, because it's complicated enough for somebody that has only looked at the Smith chart now in the last couple of weeks to understand where we're going. That's why I'm trying to stay with it. Simplest factors of the Smith chart, just to, like you say, you know, it's like learning wheels on a, you take your little kid and you want them to learn how to ride a two-wheeler, you take the two learning wheels on and bit by bit you can raise them up a little bit till, you know, they learn to balance and just in case they still, you know, are scared, they can always feel they lean back on the, you know, two helper wheels. So basically I try to I'm trying to do the same thing here with the Smith chart, so I am really simplifying a lot of factors in it. Well, anyway, let's see, where were we? Oh, wait a minute, I think we're in net mode now. Okay, anyway, we extended that that line that from the point O right through to the 1.0, right straight through to the end, and where this line we just drew crosses our original circle that we drew through with point O. I want you to put a little B there. And also the same thing where the line exits the edge of the chart, put another B. Now, as we are mentioning in conductance and susceptance, gotta get that word out, susceptance. At the point B we just had, that will represent G minus JB. Conductance minus J susceptance. A little word on that. I see if I can explain this simply. In admittance data, our plus J reactance, our inductive reactance, becomes negative. in this factor, in subsistence. I hope I said that right, Dick.
In a way you did. Anybody who studies complex math, that's where, what is complex math? Complex math means what is the square root of minus 1. Square root of minus 1 is called an imaginary number. We call it I for imaginary. And so the value of doing that is that I squared is minus 1, but I itself, what is it? It really means 90 degrees of phase shift. And whether the 90 degrees of phase shift is clockwise, you call it positive, or it's counterclockwise, you call it negative I, positive I, negative I. I is an imaginary number. It really means you're drawing some kind of a graph, and you're going to be representing phase angle by way of the I, and the real component with the R or the G. So 1 over J equals minus J. So I have to go through a whole bunch of steps to prove that. 1 over J equals J, minus J. Or 1 over minus J equals positive J. So when Mel drew the line through the Smith chart such that he went from impedance to admittance, really is doing a dividing process. Therefore, the J, the imaginary number, shifted in sign. That's sort of what's going on. Again, it won't seem to make a lot of sense at first. And so you've been through the operation a couple of times, and all of a sudden you'll say, yeah, I see what's going on. So the fact that your reactance that was positive, it was an inductor, became a negative susceptance. It became a shunt inductor, which is a negative reactive component called susceptance. That's what happened. That's why it became negative. 1 over I shifts phase, shifts sign. It helps a little bit. I know it's not super clear. Mel's trying to keep it simple. I'm trying to make it complicated. Sorry about that. You got it, Mel?
Basically, what I'm trying to do is just get people used to be able to use the edge of the chart that we have. This is basically what I'm trying to allude to right now. If you'll notice, this line, it just went straight through the edge of the chart. We're going to read the wavelength now off the edge. Now, you'll notice you see 0.33, 0.33, and it cuts right through there, and it's 0.336 wavelength of a wavelength, if you'll notice that at point B. Or, if you look at the angle, it equals minus 62 degrees. Now, that's one way of using the edge of the chart. Now, what we're doing now, because we added this piece of wire, we're going to have what you may say a shift over a little bit, but we still are on dealing with our 50 ohm cable. Now we're going to draw another line starting at 1.0. Now look at our circle that we drew. You'll notice it cuts through or crosses the circle of the 1.0. As the circle goes through to 1.0, the 50 ohm circle, the 50 ohm resistance circle. And you'll notice the circle that we drew crosses it at a point. And if you look at that point over there, you can mark it A. I'll tell you the point is actually 1.0 minus J 0.67. And that should be approximately where you'll find it. Any questions? Okay, taking our straight edge again, from 1.0 through this point A that we just marked, go straight through the edge of the chart and mark that A. All right, now, you read now, we're going to read the information on the edge of the chart here, and it says that we are now 0.348 wavelength and an angle of minus 71 degrees. Does everybody see that, or do I have to clarify that? Okay. Now, the difference, here's where we have our simplicity of this. This distance between A and B, C comes off there, at 348, 0.348, and 0.336. If we subtract that, that's going to give us 0.012 wavelength. And that'll give us the distance that our stub has to be replaced. We put the T in the line at approximately 0.012 wavelengths away from our transmitter. The 248.348 represents the length of our stub. Simply converting that, we can convert that to meters, or if you want to convert it to meters, if you want to convert it to feet, inches, whatever way you want to convert it from. That's the information. So now we know that our distance is 012 or 90 degrees electrical, or our length of our stub is 348 wavelength or 251 degrees electrical. With that information, it's simple enough. Now, we measured that from the line. Let me let it drop. Notice we measured that. We got that 0.348 because we measured from that line that sent the line that goes right through, because you'll notice at the left end of it, it said short circuit, and that's basically what we have. The length of this cable, the end of this length of this cable is a short circuit, so that's why we measured all the way around from that point. I hope I didn't confuse too many people. You clarify it, over.
Yeah. What Mel's doing, I'm going to show you where he's going. By using the chart and flipping from impedance to admittance and measuring the angles around the perimeter, he's trying to find two things. One, how many feet or inches back from the antenna is the ideal place to put the stub. There's a magic place you want to put the stub, and there's a magic length of the stub itself. So he's trying to find in electrical wavelengths or electrical degrees. 360 degrees is a wavelength, by the way. So whether you express it in electrical degrees or inches or feet of cable, how many inches or feet of cable back from the antenna or forward from the transmitter, depending on which way he does it, are you going to hang the stub, and how long the sharp stub should be. And the magic of what he's doing is that when he finds the magic location and the magic for the stub and the magic length for the stub in one swell swoop, putting in one T connector and a length of cable, he now has a high power capacitor or inductor, whichever he's generating, in just the right condition on the line, that from there on all the way back toward the transmitter, the line is a one-to-one standing wave ratio at that frequency. So he's probably doing it from back from the antenna. There's a magic location, a small distance back from the antenna, where you hang the stub, and at one step, you've now taken your antenna, which is not so great, it's got almost a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you make it 1-to-1 from there on down. So the length of cable between his stub and the antenna, you could call it the matchbox. That length of cable plus his stub, you can put it all inside a box if you want. You call it a matchbox, and that's a beautifully weatherproof matchbox hanging up in the air with his antenna. And the rest of the transmission line sees a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. You get the minimum loss of the line. You get the happiest transmitter, and he's done it all in one step. There are other ways of doing it in 2 or 3 steps and maybe making it a little bit more broadband. And some number of lectures downrange, we may go there. For the time being, in one nice, carefully chosen step with this chart, he's finding out where to hang the stub, how long the stub should be, and now he makes his antenna nearly perfect at this frequency. I think that's what's going on. K2KUI, K2IW, the TechNet.
Actually, that's what I was showing. Very simple. Just basically, this would be give people an insight in the use of the edge of the chart, what that means, because I had a couple of questions. What does the jazz on the edge of the chart mean? So that's just giving a idea of what the edge of the chart, what its capabilities is. Now, once, for instance, Dick says you can make up a nice little tchotchke like that with a piece of cable and a roller, do whatever you like with it. Now, for instance, let's take, the application of this. If we went to the 20-meter band, and this was on 20 meters, and we went down to the CW portion of the band around 14.0, and we applied this, we would find that if, 14.0 comes out to 21.428 meters. That's what 14.0 is in wavelength. Now, if we take that, and we would easily convert that now, that at 14.0, we have 7.44 meters of length of cable. And if we want to turn that into feet, we can divide it by 0.3048 feet. And we do the same thing with the distance. Take the distance and do it the same way. So you see, very simply put, and just drawing a couple of lines, You can imagine how much effort we'll save by making up this simple matching network here, which is the length of cable and a couple of connectors. Really take you out of a bind under such situation like being at a field day and everybody is looking around, gee, what do we didn't bring tuners, we didn't think about it. How do we get the antennas on the CW portion of the band? Well, you can whip out the old Smith chart and say, I'll give you the answer. I hope there's anybody have any questions out there. I hope I didn't confuse too many people over.
It's kind of quiet. It's a good time, Bill.
Wait till the emails come. Well, anyhow, I think this is basically a very simple method showing a matching system. Least amount of mathematics involved. And I think it's a fairly effective way to match a situation like this, Dick. What do you think, over?
I like it. Now, you can do it at a certain location with a certain length of stub. That is a short-circuited stub. Most people do that when they're doing a shunt inductor. If they make the stub less than a quarter wave long, or it becomes a shunt capacitor if the stub is longer than a quarter wave. Or there's a slightly different location where you do the opposite, where you, instead of using a short-circuited stub, it's an open-circuited stub. And so a guy who's a little bit more skilled on the Smith chart will do the problem both ways, if he's got the time. Sometimes good enough is good enough. You found a solution, it's a length of cable, you got it in the junk box, you got the T-connector, you can install it, and you go away and say, hey, that's good enough. But there are times when if you study the problem with a shunt inductor stub, and then you restudy the problem in a slightly different location of the transmission line, you put a shunt capacitor stub, you'll get another solution. And usually the best solution, the one that has the shortest length of cable between the antenna and the stub, that's the solution that usually gives you the most amount of bandwidth. But occasionally it's an inconvenient location, because that's where the transmission line is going past the ductwork of the building, so to speak, and you don't want to hang it there. And you're willing to sacrifice a little bit of bandwidth to go down to a place that's more convenient. So knowing that there's a whole series of answers, a shunt capacitive stub and a shunt inductive stub, one or the other, at slightly different locations, it's nice to know that there's two. There's a whole series of other solutions where you put more than one stub simultaneously, and it becomes a double-tuned filter if you want to do that. I'm not saying you have to learn these things now. Just put that in the back of your mind, knowing that there's a lot of ways to skin this particular cat. So you can put a whole lot of these tchotchkes in there, and you end up with a hazarai. KQRIW Technique. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, Roger. Well, one of the things that people can easily remember and just get used to using this chart, I'll try to, you know, actually, I'm trying to touch upon all parts of Smith chart. We went through the resistance, the reactance circles and all, and now we've got to the weak link, the edge of the Smith chart, went through the nomograph, the bottom. And so at least people have an insight. I got one email from a guy who said to me, he says his vertical came with it, without a radio kit, this option of, you know, you get the radio kit. And in the radio kit, they tell you you can add more radios, and he couldn't really see what the heck is going on. And he started fooling with adding radios and making measurements and all, and he was able to first, he says, he's proud that he was able to actually plot basically what's happening on the Smith chart for the first time and see what's going on. So it's encouraging to hear that, Dick, over.
Sounds like fun. Now, in this particular example that you just gave us tonight, Mel, you could, if you want to, go the next step where you've calculated wavelengths or degrees of cable, meaning length of transmission line back to where you put the stub, and then length of the stub itself. You could boil it down into, as I said, wavelengths or degrees of each of those, and therefore you can boil that down into feet back and feet of cable, or inches back and inches of cable. I wonder if you boiled it into feet or inches, Mel, go ahead.
Well, I brought it down to 7.44, at 14.0, as I think. You divide that to 300,000, and that'll give you 21.428 meters. Now you can take that and easily get 7.44 meters in length of the cable and 0.26 meters distance. And of course, if you want to change that into feet, all you have to do is divide that by 0.3048. Divide that by 0.3048, and that'll give it to you in feet and inches, Dick, over.
Yeah, my favorite way of measuring, there's a whole lot of decimal places you can use to convert between inches and feet and meters and so on. 2.54 centimeters is 1 inch. That's exact. That's a definition. 2.54 centimeters is 1 inch. Also, 39.37 inches is a meter. 39.37 inches is a meter. I think that one's a slight round off. But the 2.54 centimeters equal 1 inch. That one's exact. To me, that's the easiest way to remember. And so if I want to, how many feet is in a meter? I take 39.37, that's the number of inches in a meter, divide by 36. Or correction, divide by 12. That's the number of inches in a foot. And when I do that, which I'm about to do, 39.37, did I put that in there right? Yes, I did. Divided by 12. So, to me, a meter is 3.2808 feet long. 3.2808 feet is 1 meter. And to the nearest four decimal places, that's good enough. And so, I live in the feet and inches world. And as I've dealt with, let me drop, people who live in South America, when I was talking to my buddy down there in La Salina, Chile, who works with the European Southern Observatory, and he's a real damn good power supply expert. Boy, he's written an extremely nice switching power supply, high power thing in the December 1999 and the January 2000 issue of QST Magazine. Manfred Mundenrig is his name. I'm trying to remember his call letters now. Can't remember him anyhow. He made this beautiful, I think it was a 400-watt switching 12-volt power supply. And, or is it an inverter? No, it was a power supply. And so you talk to anybody in almost every country in Central America, South America, almost every country in Europe, most of Japan, almost all of Australia, 90-some-odd percent of the rest of the world live in meters, live in liters. So they measure petrol in liters, they measure distance in meters and kilometers, and that's 90-some-odd percent of the world. And most of the time, Mike makes right. We think we, the United States, are a powerful country. We live in gallons and horsepower and miles. The rest of the world doesn't measure power in horsepower. They measure it in watts. They don't measure distance in miles. They measure it in kilometers. They don't measure liquids in gallons. They measure it in cubic liters, well, just plain liters, cubic centimeters, and grams. And we live in pounds, and they live in grams and kilograms. 90-some-odd percent of the rest of the world. It's a sobering experience to do any international business and find out that by their standards, there are 300 and some odd countries in the world, and about 300 of them think that we're in the dark ages. We haven't joined the rest of the world. We haven't joined the metric system. So it's quite humbling to find this out. Doing international business, you're going to find it. So now you know my favorite conversion. 39.37 inches is a meter. 2.54 centimeters is an inch. I haven't got a nice, convenient way of converting from liters to gallons. When it comes to kilometers, there's something like 1.6 kilometers per mile. I have to go through the 39.37 inches to get there. That's my way of remembering it. It's a couple more steps in my handheld calculator, and that handheld calculator is in my pocket 15 hours of every day. Because no matter where I go, somebody needs some kind of a conversion, or they need some kind of an impedance match, and I can do it with that calculator. It's my security blanket. It's crazy to be dependent on a thing like that. But that's the world I live in. You got it, Mel. K2LIW in the Tech Man.
K2ACB.
Mr. ACB, start off with your name, sir, and then give us your comment.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. And IVX, I forgot to mention in medicine. Medicine is still, you know, it's in the metric system. And all doctors get any drugs, you have to give any shots, any dosage is not, medicine, which is the metric.
Alan, we got a little bit of your message. You were there 20% of the time, the rest was pure dropout. K2ACB, K2RIW, and the TechNet. But I know what you're getting at. The physicians have essentially gone over to metric. They give injections in cc's, milliliters. They measure the distance in what they call femtometers. When they talk about dilation of a lady who's about to give birth, they measure that in femtometers. The rest of the world calls it centimeters. But the physicians want to be a little bit different. We'll give them that. So, almost everything in medicine and pharmacology, I think, is done metric, with rare exceptions. Is that true, Alan?
Mars Global Surveyor, the one that's operating the longest out of the four that have been presently operating. That thing's been going since 1999. And they've lost contact with that about a week ago. They made a routine adjustment on the solar arrays. They do that to try to pick up the best solar arrays in the panel. And when they did it, they didn't get a response, and one thing led to another, and they do have backup equipment on. Everything's redundant. And it turns out one of the motors, like, failed that operate that. And they went to a backup motor, and they did get one little response, but that was it. And they haven't had contact with that thing in many, many days. So that thing could be in trouble. They have some hope, you know, for it, because it goes into a safe mode, and it'll actually turn itself, the whole spacecraft, to face the sun, and not getting a signal or whatever various problems might creep up. But in turning the whole spacecraft, now you're turning the antenna away from the deep space network on Earth, so it might have lost contact for that reason. And maybe they'll regain it in, you know, the future. They got their fingers crossed. Let me drop it a second there.
Yep.
I realize we're on the mode here. We go to a lower power. Always on my computer there, Dick. So the other spacecraft that are flying around up there, you've got the Mars Express. And that's the one that's been up there for quite a few years by the European Space Agency. That's the one that had a piggyback attached to it, the Beagle 2, which unfortunately crash-landed into the Mars surface. And then you have Mars Odyssey, which went into orbit and started operating in 2001. That's all American, and that's excellent. And when I say all American, all of these spacecraft do have foreign components on it. A lot of the sensors and, you know, some of the RF radar equipment that they use, like made in Italy and places like that, so Germany. Quite a few countries are involved in all of these spacecraft. I don't think there's any strictly just a, you know, all-American spacecraft anymore. Yeah, I mean, even Cassini and Galileo were all laden with many different countries contributing to the to their project. And one of the other spacecraft that you have also in Mars orbit is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's flying at a little lower altitude, and that's a bigger spacecraft. And that's the last one that just went into final orbit. It took 6 months to aerobrake to go from a highly elliptical orbit down to its present 160-mile altitude. And that's the one with all the super cameras and everything on board. If they do not hear from the Mars Global Surveyor in a couple of weeks, they're going to use the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to actually take a picture of the spacecraft. They can do this. Every now and then they close in with about 60 miles of each other. And I've done it before, and they will do it again, and they'll point one of those high-resolution cameras toward the Mars Global Surveyor, and they want to take a look at the configuration of the arrays. So if they don't get, you know, contact within a week or so, you'll probably see that on the news. I think that would definitely make the news, taking a picture of that thing. Let me drop it a second.
K2ACB, am I coming through now? Okay, Dick.
Yes, you are, Alan. Stand by a second, Paul. Why don't you repeat your message, Alan, because on your last transmission, absolutely nothing came through. Hopefully you're in a better location or a little higher power. Go ahead.
Yeah, I originally called, I was on the Sapan Sea Bridge, and then I was in White, I'm still in White Plains, but I should be home soon. I'm in Westchester where I live. And I did say that the United States, I think, and its possessions are the only place that does use the the feet and everything else. I go to Canada a lot. Canada is on the metric system now. But what I also said is that for a while, they used to give on TV the weather in both Celsius and Fahrenheit. They stopped doing that a few years ago. But if you still see some public temperature thermometers in the city, some of them alternate between Celsius and Fahrenheit. There are quite a few of them. So that still goes. They have stopped on the television and radio. I wish they would continue to give the weather in Celsius as well as Fahrenheit. Dick, over.
Rich recognized now. Alan, I think you work in medicine, and I believe most of medicine is metric. Is that true?
Yeah, I do not work in medicine. I have a legal and social science background, so I'm not an expert in that. But Rich would know because he takes some drugs. But all the drugs and everything that I'm used to is in the metric system. Well, do you have anything to say about that, Rich?
You got it, Rich.
Okay, well, even if you look at a tektronic scope, it's in centimeters, the gradients are in centimeters. What I was going to say, Dick, first of all, I got some interesting news for the net. If you want to hear what's going on in Canada, and I can tell you what Alan says is true, there's a station on 900 kilohertz even. They come blasting in from dusk to dawn. They sound like a local station. When I go out to Dunkin' Donuts around 4:35 in the morning, they sound like a local station. And they give the morning news and the weather all in metric.
Yeah, when I was using my satellite system and I used to listen to the CBC North, Canadian Broadcasting System for the northern sections of Canada, in the wintertime their weather reports are really interesting sounding. They would talk about minus 60 tonight and it'll warm up to minus 40 tomorrow, centigrade. Turns out that the one point that corresponds is minus 40 centigrade and minus 40 Fahrenheit are the same point. We would call it 60 below zero to 40 below zero warm up during the day. They live with the negative temperature so much in northern Canada that they just call it minus 60 at night, warming up to minus 40. That's the temperature portion of the weather report. And they got a zillion different ways of describing snow. I've had a lot of fun listening to what the weather is like in that part of the world and realizing that my standards life there is kind of rough. Anything further you want to tell us about any of this jazz, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, well, I have something on an unrelated subject, which I'd like to get into in a few minutes, concerning you had brought up heat stroke and confusion and, what's the word I'm looking for? Dehydration. You may have saved a life, Dick, unknowingly. I'd like to tell you about it. But, you don't need anything special to hear what's going on. 900 kilohertz on the AM dial is a clear channel. No interference from News Radio 88, which is kind of surprising. Jerry, what's his call? I can't think of Jerry's call right now. He told me about the station. And it's kind of interesting to listen to the news from the Canadian slant. And they do give the weather all in metric.
Costing your car a metric, Dick.
The clock in my car is in metric. Yeah, that's true. Wait a minute now. Is a 24-hour system metric? I guess you could call it that if you wanted to. Interesting. Never thought about that. I also got this metric conversion chart that converts cycles per second into hertz, but that's not a joke. Let's let Paul finish, and then we'll go over to Rich's other subject to discuss. WS2N, sorry for the interruption. You got it, Paul.
Okay, and Rich, I won't be long, so we don't have that much here. That takes care of the Mars story, and
KF2TV.
Countries getting involved with one another. Russia and China are now talking. They would like to join up and develop a future cooperation between the two, with moon spacecraft and Mars spacecraft. They'd like to send a lander to the Mars. They'd like to definitely put a lander on Phobos, one of the moons around Mars. The Russians tried that years ago and it failed. And they'd like to do it again, and this time they might be doing it with cooperation with China. A lot of their rockets are very similar. China's design is very similar to the Russian Soyuz spacecraft. So with China up in space now with two flights under their belt, first one a one-man mission, and the second one was two men on board, and a third one coming up this next year, another flight. Things are getting very international. Right now, China is pretty much on their own. They don't contribute to any of our experiments. But that might change. You've had the NASA administrator go over to China recently, or dealing with them, let me drop it. And I think they're eventually working on some kind of an agreement. I could picture someday them getting involved with the International Space Station, ferrying equipment up there. That could be a possibility. Even India. India has launched many rockets and satellites. They're thinking about a manned flight program seriously, and they'd like to put their first manned flight up in 2014 and shoot for the moon in 2020. I think these are optimistic projections for them, but they're sure thinking about it. So, and as far as the Hubble Space Telescope, I know a lot of equipment. You know, when you see these astronauts installing these gigantic refrigerator-sized pieces of equipment, a lot of the electronics and things that are involved are involved with different countries. Which ones, offhand, I don't know. I know Italy and Germany are definitely involved with some of the equipment. The next manned mission coming up, STS-116, will now be launched December 7th. Let me drop it. I forget we're on the we're not on the net mode here.
I just wanted to say I've reached my home. Everybody have a good night. K2ACB will be off and clear.
Going up later in the month. They upped this a little earlier. They're actually worried about having the computers operate going through the year. If the mission extends past December to January, they're concerned about it. I mean, it's almost like the Y2K thing again, you know. And I've heard this before. A couple of years ago, they were planning a flight around December, and they gave this a thought, and now they're thinking about it again. So December 7th, you're looking at a good 10, 13-day mission. I think it's three different spacewalks. They're going to install a P5 truss, another one of these truss segments on the port side. They have the P's and then the S's, ports and starboard. So you hear P5, P4, another port section. Now this is a lot smaller than the last one, but it's an important space, and it goes in that length of truss, which will be like longer than the length of a football field eventually. There's 11 segmented pieces that will eventually be attached to one another. Much more. I mean, it's like 25% the size of the last one that went up. That was a monster. That was almost like 2-in-1. That had the rotating piece on it and all. So, yeah, this thing's only like 11 feet long, but it's still 14 by 14. Big box, boxy truss segment that will be going up. And on a spacewalk, they're going to be rewiring the space station. A lot of different things that need to be done. Getting ready for future solar panels, future radiators. They have to radiate a lot of heat out into space that gets enveloped into the inside the space station. That's a strange effect. Very hard to, they really have to get a lot of, give a lot of thought to getting rid of heat inside the space station. It's an unusual problem. All the walls are so well insulated and all. Any heat that's generated from the bodies of the people and any equipment inside, they have to get it out there. That's why there's all this ammonia piping that's involved on the outside of the space station going to those big radiators. They're all not solar panels. A lot of them are radiators. Hope I didn't time it out. I'll turn it back to you, Dick. K2.
You person, well, you absolutely didn't time out, Paul, so don't worry. All's well. Quick question, Paul. Have you heard in the last year or two, what is the projected life of the International Space Station? What's your best guess as to how many more years we intend to use it with the current plan?
The current plan was to be built by, 2006. That was supposed to be the completion date, and then they said 15 years after that. So, if they're going to base it on that, you'd have to say 15 years beyond 2006. Some of the earlier components would start to see the day. Naturally, I don't think that's so. Take many of these missions, the Hubble, the Galileo that's around Jupiter. I don't know how many extensions, 2 year extensions they got on that. Cassini is a 4 year mission. I'm sure that's going to get a couple of extensions. They're usually 2 year extensions. The Mars rovers running around on Mars, you know, they were hoping for 3 months. They're coming up to, what was it, 3 years. Probably in 2006, no, 2 years or three? I'm not going to lose track. 2004, yeah, it'll be 2 years, January 3rd and January 14th, respectively, for the Mars rovers. It's unbelievable. So I expect the space station to be up there, operational. I'm thinking the next 20, 25 years, back to the WS.
Yeah, if I take 15 years and add it to 2006, I'm up to 2021. I calculate what my age is going to be then, and I think it's going to be lasting longer than that. Have you seen the news report that the Cassini spacecraft has measured this huge hurricane at the south pole of Saturn? And I think that that hurricane is almost as large in diameter as the Earth, and it's got ridiculously high velocity. It's a, I think it's a counterclockwise turning hurricane at the at the South Pole. Have you seen those pictures that have been on the news this week, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, I did. I did see that. And, well, Saturn has the highest wind out of all the planets, even higher than Jupiter. They have 1,100 mile an hour winds on a regular basis. So, I forgot now. I think this storm was 1,000 miles across. The eye was 1,000. Some bizarre number. And the winds were phenomenal. I think they were 400 mile an hour winds or some bizarre number. I can't recall. But yeah, I did see the pictures.
Strange world. Another report that I saw is that the current thinking, I guess this was in Sky and Telescope or Astronomy Magazine in the last month or two, the best thinking right now is to why does Venus have no moon, and why is Venus turning in the wrong direction? And the best thinking right now is that our moon is not a capture device, that we had a huge impact that took a great big chunk of the Earth, scattered it in orbit around the Earth. That stuff re-coalesced and turned into the moon. The one or two major impacts that Venus had, and Venus is going to have more impacts because it's closer to the sun, it's closer to the center of gravity attraction when it comes to junk coming in from the outside universe. So during the early years when there was a lot of impacts, the best thinking is that Venus got impacted at least once and maybe twice. One of those impacts was so big that it spun the planet in the other direction, and that the first impact and the second impact each created a moon, and those two moons came together and crashed into the planet. right now the thinking is that Venus once had a moon. Our moon, as you know, is very important to us for a whole bunch of reasons. It gives us much more stability in the tilt of our rotation on our axis. So, and what it does to the tides also is believed a strong influence when it comes to creating biological life by a spontaneous process. And an awful lot of scientists believe that's the way it all came about. We've all had a pretty violent past. Quite possibly Mercury is also quite a few times. And our moon has had some huge impact events, obvious by the fact that it's got a peculiar kind of mass concentration. It's not a completely round object. it is lockstep in the way it goes around the Earth, partially because it has a mass concentration. It's not a completely round body of homogeneous material. So you probably, if you happen to get the sky and telescope, you can read about this in the latest couple of issues. They're also slowly...
The time?
They're slowly coming to the conclusion that what we call universe, not all there is. That there is multiple universes, multiverses. They're finding more and more evidence of that as they dig into the, what is it called now? Wilkinson anisotropy probe. Yeah. Probe that made microkelvins and millikelvins measurements of the temperature of the universe in various directions. As you study that data, they're starting to see evidence of multiple universes. And so I'm still holding out hope that what are the explanations for what's called dark energy? In other words, the stuff out at the perimeter of our observable universe is all accelerating away from us. So in the beginning, they used to think that some mysterious force called dark energy was pushing it away. I think almost everything in the universe is attractive, not repulsive, with the exception of electrostatic repulsion and magnetic repulsion, both of which are relatively short-range phenomena, whereas gravity is an extremely long-range phenomena. So all the long-range phenomena appear to be attractive, not repulsive. So the dark energy acceleration of stuff out at the perimeter of our observable universe, I think, is material being sucked over the hill into the next universe. And it'll be interesting to see all the times that I've said that at various astronomy meetings, and people say, no, that's too simple. Wouldn't it be nice if that's the explanation? We'll soon find out. Anyone with any further comments or questions on all that they've heard tonight, give me a call, letters and name right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
I know why they don't like that idea, Dick.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Because everywhere you look, if you look up, it's one big sphere completely surrounding it. No matter which direction you look, all the way to the end, everything's accelerating. So that's why they're saying that there's dark energy. For them to believe that there's universe out there in one direction, okay, that area would be accelerating. Everywhere you look, accelerating equally, that means there's, one big universe surrounding us, the whole spherical universe surrounded by another big universe, or just millions of universes all around the perimeter. You know, you have to believe that we're in the middle of one gigantic universe completely surrounding us, or that there's countless universes at no matter what degree, what azimuth or elevation you look in the sky. There's got to be another universe there, everywhere. You know, that would be kind of hard to accept. I think that's why they have trouble with that.
WB2HWW.
How we recognized, of your two possible explanations there, Paul, I accept the first one. I think there is a huge universal universe. Majority of it is beyond our observable distance. The best evidence of that, in my opinion, is you choose any direction you want to, the so-called dark direction for the deep field and ultra-deep field Hubble picture. You integrate for 1 million seconds in that direction, and you see 2,600 galaxies you've never seen before. You give me a big enough telescope, you give me a long enough integration time in the picture, and you're going to see a lot more stuff at a lot greater distance than you ever knew that was there. We'd like to believe that the observable universe is the end of the distance of the stuff that we care about. I think it's very naive. I think there's a huge, real universe out there. By the standards of that huge, real universe, there was a local explosion around us that we call the Big Bang. And once again, we used to think the Big Bang is all there was. Well, we're going through our fourth or fifth stage of humbling. We used to think everything in the universe revolved around the Earth. It doesn't. And we thought that's the Ptolemaic system, and then Copernican convinced us everything goes around the Sun. Well, it doesn't. Well, almost everything goes around the center of our galaxy, our island universe. Yeah, locally that's true. So we're not the center when it comes to the Earth, we're not the center when it comes to our Sun, we're not the center when it comes to our galaxy, we're not the center when it comes to our galactic group, we're not the center of our universe. That's the fourth or fifth level of humbling. I think we're about to be humbled again. Maybe we deserve it. go ahead, Howie.
Want to stand by, Dick. When you're finished with the space stuff, I'd just like to go over a couple of things you spoke about earlier tonight.
Okay, we've also got Rich waiting in the wings. Let's make sure that Paul has had a chance to finish what he and I are discussing. So, of your two explanations, I like the first one, Paul. And I think there's a huge, real universe out there. And what we call the universe is a local phenomenon. A darn big one, but it's a local phenomenon. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I also like the membrane theory with multiverses side by side, different dimensions. But we won't get into that one. But that one I like, too. And you have energy popping in and out every now and then, and this is forgetting the dark energy. That one is really good. What's that one guy, Ed? It's like the new Einstein. I got no more of my books here. Ed's talking about it. He came up with the STEM theory. That's a good one. Now, Dick, I'll turn it back to you. And, okay, on the Venus, and I won't see that. I don't get a giant telescope. I usually look at that in a store or a library. I do get astronomy delivered out there. I'll forward to some of those articles. Sometimes that magazine has similar articles. And, yeah, okay, yeah, they believe many decades now that so-called Orpheus planet, they gave it a name, Mars-like planet, hit the Earth, and maybe even got us at a 23 and a third degree angle, and definitely created the moon. All the different rocks on the moon are very similar to the Earth, and Apollo astronauts brought them back and said, hey, look at this. And that really started to reinforce that thinking. Okay, very good. We'll finish up with the space portion of the net, and turn it back to you, Dick, WS2X.
Very fine, Paul, and thank you. Rich and Torillo, what were you about to bring to our attention? K2RIW and TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet. Why Mark and Torillo? First of all, I wonder if you recall a discussion in August of this year during the heat wave, we were discussing heat stroke and what it can do to people, especially the elderly.
Oh, boy, I was on that particular hobby horse for some time. That it is such an extremely preventable death that 14,000 people died in the vicinity of Paris because of a heat wave, because it occurred during a holiday, and the right information wasn't given to the people, and their relatives were on holiday and not monitoring them. That's a lot of useless death for such a very simple solution. So I was unhappy about the fact that our major media was giving people Our major media was giving people what they want, not what they need. What they needed is information on how to survive. And it's a very simple survival tactic with reference to a heat wave killing people. Back to you, Rich. N2EO, T2RIW, you got it, Rich.
I'm going to make it quick. Let's see if I got it here. Okay. October 20th, my father was complaining of confusion. So I rushed him over to the emergency room at North Shore Hospital. And this is the case in point, if you don't have somebody watching over the elderly, they write them off as being old and senile and, well, he's had a good life, that sort of thing. What had happened to my father was he had confusion. They thought he had a stroke, which he did not have a stroke. They diagnosed him incorrectly as they saw I'll be with you in a second. They saw nodules on the pancreas, on the bladder, on the lungs, and anyway, they told him basically to go home and die. They said he was riddled with cancer, which was not true. I took him to my doctor. They found that he had lung cancer, never smoked in his life. Oddly enough, his brother, who never smoked, also died from lung cancer. And what we found was, I gotta get going here in a second, but what we found was that he was in heat stroke. He was acting very confused. We put him on on Gatorade. And he came back to normal within 24 hours, Dick. I gotta run and help him. I'm just gonna be back. Enter Rio.
Yeah, there are smart physicians that